I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. An article in the Boston Globe a little while ago caught our attention, and why wouldn't it, when it started like this. 2016 is quietly shaping up as a good year for peace in the world. You read that right. A significant escalation of war over the past few years is at the moment abating. We're going to be talking about the parts of the world that are still quite troubled and where they are, looking at the new wars that have cropped up, and looking at the level of violence in a place like Syria, where it has been horrendous. There was, when the article was written, a ceasefire that was in place. Did that last? Has the fighting abated somewhat in Syria? And why is it that the numbers have gone down quite a bit for nearly two-thirds of a century, from 45 to 2011, our guest writes, war had been in overall decline. Our guest is Professor Joshua Goldstein. He's a professor emeritus of international relations at American University, research scholar in the Department of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts. He is the author of several books, including War and Gender, How Gender Shapes the War System and Vice Versa, Winning the War on War, The Decline of Armed Conflict Worldwide, and The Wounds Within, about veterans and PTSD. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Goldstein. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on email, and that's that's Twitter, at K Dunn Show. I can't remember all of these. I say them all the time. And then if you want the email, it's talk@WPR.org. There we go. Professor Joshua Goldstein, thank you so much for being with us.
It's nice to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So, you know, I read this paragraph and I had to stop and say, really? It was a good year for peace in the world?
Yeah,
overall.
Not if you live in Syria.
Right.
But for the world overall, most of the regions of the world are now at peace, and the wars that remain are smaller overall, fewer, and more geographically confined now to an arc that runs from about Nigeria over to Pakistan. And the other 5/6 of the people in the world are living in pretty peaceful regions. Now, if you're in that arc, it's not so great.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in Syria, it's really terrible. It's horrendous, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take the big picture, there used to be a lot more Syrias, a lot more places like that. So if you're in the middle of a place where a war is going on, or for that matter, in the middle of a terrorist attack, it's just as bad as ever. But fewer people are in the middle of those places because there's less of that stuff going on. That's,
mm-hmm.
that's the big point.
Syria is by far the world's largest war, you write.
Yes.
And there was, when you wrote the article a few months ago, I think there was a partial ceasefire in place that looked promising. What happened?
Well, it was partial, and it brought down the level of violence by more than half, which is good, but it never led to a permanent solution, a political settlement there, and then fighting has picked up again since then. The great powers are not on the same page about it, obviously, and we're still looking for some solution there. It's just a terrible situation.
Mm-hmm. What about in Iraq?
Iraq has gone through ups and downs. There has been a lot of progress lately in trying to get ISIS out of the big territory that they've controlled, and that's going forward. But the country has never really recovered from the American invasion, well, from Saddam Hussein and then the American invasion and then the civil war that followed that, the Shia-Sunni split. And so it's still a country trying to patch itself back together. Certainly better than it was a few years after we went over there, but still a pretty violent place.
And I'm reminded, as you take us through the various spots where war is going on or significant skirmishes, and we'll get into terrorism in a moment, I'm reminded of Afghanistan, which has been going on, it seems like, forever and just doesn't make the news very much at all anymore, maybe because it's been going on forever. It drags on, you say, with no signs of respite.
Yeah, it's just been dragging on. And it's not a very big war. It's not as big as Syria. It's kind of grinding lower level violence, and it's just been going forever because you remember the Soviet Union was in there and the Americans were in there. There were civil wars in between that. So it's not a positive outcome there, but it's not the worst kind of war that you would see in the world. It's not as bad as Syria, and it's nowhere near the big wars of the past, the kind of India versus Pakistan, Iran versus Iraq, you know, big wars between countries. And that's the most positive thing in the world today, these big world wars between national armies that used to happen regularly throughout most of history are not happening anymore. And those national armies are heavily armed with, you know, airplanes, artillery, tanks, submarines, you name it. And 20 million soldiers worldwide are in those armies, but they're not fighting each other anymore.
Why?
Sometimes there's little flare-ups. We just had one in Armenia versus Azerbaijan not long ago. But when those flare-ups happen, they seem to die out pretty quickly. So that's a big change, because historically those have been the biggest and most deadly, most destructive wars, and we don't seem to be having them anymore. So we're doing something right there.
What
we're left with is the civil wars.
And what are we doing right with the big wars? Why are they not happening anymore?
Well, we've brought the countries of the world into the United Nations, and that's historically a new thing. We tried it with the League of Nations, didn't work out, and we tried again with the United Nations, and it was stop and go during the Cold War. But after the Cold War ended, we have made that system work pretty well. We have a UN charter. We have a lot of mechanisms now for resolving conflicts short of war, tribunals and arbitrations and diplomacy that weren't available historically, and so resort to full-scale war is not the first option anymore. And it's also become very expensive for these armies to fight each other. And countries and people have realized that the way to get ahead in the world, the way for politicians to hold on to power, is to get rich and to trade, not to make war and conquer. So it used to be that you'd get ahead by conquering territory and taxing it, and you'd make money that way, but that doesn't work anymore. Now you get rich by trading. And China is the prime example of this. They've gotten so much more prosperous by being part of a world trading system, and the moment China went to war, that would all be threatened. So China, remarkably, is the rising power that hasn't fought a single battle now in 25 years, and yet is rising in the world system.
Mm-hmm.
So their leadership now gets legitimacy, and I think this is a broader point beyond China, that the legitimacy comes from delivering prosperity to your people, not from conquering territory.
Perhaps we have, when I read that first paragraph, many people would say, really, because we're living in this age of terrorism and it's all over the news all the time and so horrific and you don't know when it's going to strike, that maybe it has all of us thinking that things are worse now than they used to be.
Yeah. Well, and if you're in the middle of a terrorist attack, things are worse, but your chance of being in the middle of a terrorist attack are so small. What's changed is that the mass media amplify these things so that we all feel like it's happening to us. Our nervous systems literally respond like, you know, we're in the middle of one of these horrible acts of atrocities of violence. And yet we're not. Very few people are. And the thing is, you know, if a plane crashes and 200 people die, everybody gets on planes the next day. We try to figure out what went wrong and fix systems so that doesn't happen so much. But we all go on with our lives. But if a terrorist attack happens and 200 people die, then it's like, you know, it takes over the news cycle for days and everybody's freaked out by it. I don't know what the answer to that is, but there's a disconnect between how we feel about the safety of the world and how things are going, and that kind of objective view that puts the big picture together.
Mm. When you were talking about countries not conquering other places, what immediately came to mind was ISIS, and I'd like for you to talk a little bit about their conquering of territory and if there are any other groups similar to ISIS that has territory on its mind.
Well, ISIS was trying to put together territory for their caliphate, and they have still control of some territory in Syria, although it's been shrinking, and they have some territory in Iraq, and that's been shrinking. They've just lost their main territory that they had grabbed on the coast in Libya, and they've lost most of their territory in Nigeria. So they're actually shrinking, and a lot of people think that's why we're seeing more of these spectacular terrorist attacks in Europe in particular, because they're turning to, you know, something else, because they're not winning on the ground in those places.
Let's go to some other parts of the world. When you talked about the geography of war shrinking, so when we look at places that had conflict in the Western Hemisphere, the ceasefire between Colombia and the FARC guerrillas ended, you say, the last active political armed conflict in the whole Western Hemisphere.
Yeah. I mean, it's remarkable. What's remarkable is that we haven't really noticed. But go back 35 years and look at the Western Hemisphere. There were military governments in a lot of the major countries, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, Bolivia, El Salvador, Panama, all had military governments and more. There were frequent coups. Countries were fighting each other, you know, regular armies fighting each other. Britain and Argentina fought a war. Ecuador and Peru fought a war. The United States fought a war against Panama. Today, there are no military governments left in all of South America, Latin America, and no countries are fighting each other. And the last of these major civil wars was the one in Colombia. It's 50, 60 years old, and now they've come to a peace settlement. So it doesn't mean that the problems are over or that violence has ended. There's still all the drug gang violence, which in some cases can be just as bad as a civil war in terms of the level of violence, again, if you're in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's domestic violence and ordinary homicide and you know, a lot of problems still, poverty, inequality. But in terms of these armed conflicts between actors trying to control governments, Marxist guerrillas trying to overthrow right-wing governments and all of that, it's just not true anymore in all of Latin America. So that's an accomplishment that should be on our top 10 list for the decade.
Mm-hmm. What about, Professor Goldstein, Africa?
Africa has made a lot of progress in the recent decades, not only in the fewer number of wars, which, as I say, are now confined to relatively few countries, and there are some serious ones, but Nigeria, South Sudan, that kind of part of northern Africa. But southern Africa, where we used to have wars in Mozambique, in Namibia, in South Africa, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where there's still a little bit of fighting going on, but nothing like it was in the 1990s. So that's all cleared out, if you will. And then in West Africa, there were terrible wars in Sierra Leone, in Ivory Coast. That area is also mostly at peace. There's this problem in Nigeria still with the Boko Haram, the ISIS affiliate there.
Mm-hmm.
And also Africa's made tremendous progress on health care. Maternal mortality is just night and day, much better than a few decades ago. Infant mortality, those kind of health indicators. Vaccinations are up, and economic growth is up too. So Africa's making there's a lot of positive things going on in Africa now.
So when you talk about what...
I just want to say that the positive things follow on having the security of not having a war going on. If there's a war going on in a country, it's very hard to have economic development. It's very hard to have positive health outcomes. So,
yes.
So that's very fundamental to the other good things that we want to happen in a society.
So would it be accurate to say then the arc of war now is pretty much confined to the countries that were a part of the Arab Spring?
Well, not all of them were. Nigeria wasn't a part of that,
right.
And Pakistan and Afghanistan weren't. But the Arab Spring countries in the middle of there, and then conversely, Egypt was part of the Arab Spring, but there's no war there now. There's a military government. So it doesn't exactly overlap, but there is this part of the world that's in turmoil, and it does overlap somewhat with the Arab Spring.
And do you have hope, because your article is hopeful, that there will be progress in those areas, in those Arab Spring countries?
Well, I do hope so, and I don't want to just be optimistic without reason, but the big factors that seem to drive this long-term push towards peace are, I would point to three things. One is prosperity. The single biggest risk factor for a civil war is poverty. And so as countries are getting more income, people are rising up out of poverty, there are fewer civil wars. And this has been the case, for instance, in East Asia, where China, Vietnam, all those countries in East Asia that were once embroiled in war, now that region is almost entirely peaceful, and I think a lot of it is that they have more money now. Mm. The second factor is norms are changing, where people used to think violence was pretty cool. It was a test of manhood and a great thing for a country to go off to war, and we just don't see it as cool so much anymore. And then the third thing is the rise of the United Nations and other international institutions, peacekeeping, things that the international community is able to use to make alternatives to war work better and to resolve conflicts, even when they do turn violent. So if I look at those factors applied in the Middle East and the regions that still have war, they are a little bit weaker there, but I think they're still moving forward. And so over maybe decades, maybe generations, I think that there's a pretty positive outlook.
We don't think war is cool anymore.
No.
Huh. Well, how did we come to that realization? We went through
a lot of that happened 100 years ago during World War One. Before World War One, people thought war was going to be really glorious, and then when people came home from World War One, that was not the story. It clearly was not glorious, and it had become mechanized and just horrible, horrendous in every way, and not chivalrous and valiant and glorious.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing since then has really turned it back into chivalrous enterprise.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. It's a very interesting article, which we do have posted on our Facebook page in case you would like to read the article. The Decline of War and Violence. It's in the Boston Globe. And Professor Joshua Goldstein is our guest this hour to talk about how the level of war violence has fallen markedly in the world. It's confined to a certain area right now, which he has outlined for us. And he's talked about the reasons for the decline. What do you think of that? Have we reached a point where war is not cool anymore? Oh, we're getting a lot of calls on this. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Our guest is Professor Emeritus of International Relations at American University, research scholar in the Department of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, and author of a number of books, including Winning the War on War, The Decline of Armed Conflict Worldwide. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Zach in Waupaca is our first caller for you. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a fascinating show. I think that the guest has a lot of excellent points with war decreasing and there being also more terrorism as a result of being a power for territory versus economic of individual country citizens. I think the argument that ISIS is trying to make, and is also why Trump is a particularly dangerous candidate, is that jihad would make that war about something else. To gain ground, basically.
Professor?
Yeah, so ISIS is trying to make, I didn't quite catch the point, that ISIS is trying to make the jihad be about something else than territorial conquest?
Yes, it turns this whole thing into, again, a fight for, you know, an actual war potentially between these civilized countries, especially when, you know, it's your neighbor against your neighbor.
If you're a nation with a whole regular army and you're trying to conquer territory, that's quite expensive and difficult to do. And if you're a disenfranchised, you know, small group like ISIS, mad about something, and willing to use extreme violence, then you can have more impact by these terrorist attacks, you know, and they seem to be just looking to become more and more horrendous as a way of staying relevant. And then you have different splinter groups that try to become more atrocious than the one before so that they can get publicity out of it. It's all kind of dependent on the news media picking up these stories and splashing them around, and then that kind of restores the norm of violence being glorious in a way for them. You know, they can have a glorious death and kill a lot of people and get a lot of publicity. We kind of play into that when we give so much attention to it and treat it as some kind of threat to our national identity, some existential threat, which actually isn't.
It would be really bad if we could get rid of it. Do you have any ideas about how we could do that?
Well, that's a complicated thing. I think taking attention off of it, in a way, is part of the solution. To not shut down everything for days on end, to all be completely focused on one of these spectacles of violence. There's a lot of other stuff going on in the world, and I don't see the need to devote entire days' worth of news cycle to every spectacle of violence. In fact, it's a little irresponsible to do that because you're just encouraging the next one. So that's part of it. And then taking away their territory, that's a hard slog that we're involved in now and having some success, and I think it is important. And then undermining the ideology by living up to our ideals, by messaging better, by providing alternatives. And then, very importantly, economic development in the poor countries. Not that the terrorists themselves are poor, they're often middle class, but there's a grievance behind it. And to the extent that we can have countries be prosperous and more fulfilled, happier as nations, there's less space for terrorism to develop there.
Well, you mentioned, number one, prosperity, poverty, the single greatest risk factor. How have we lifted, then, so many people out of poverty? Who's done that? How?
Well, We've traded. That's been a big piece of it. We've developed technologies, probably been the most important thing. And there's a process by which countries are just on their own terms developing their economies. It's kind of a natural process. If it works, if wars don't get in the way, and if corruption doesn't get in the way, which is a big problem, then technology can develop and countries can move from growing rice to manufacturing things. And with globalization at work, it is an opportunity, although it's very disruptive in the rich countries, it's an opportunity for the poor countries to make money making stuff and selling it. That's what China's done, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Zach, so much for your call. Scott in La Crosse is next. Hello, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
I've got two kind of related questions for the guests. First of all, I remember reading that the revolution is more likely to start when things start getting better rather than when everybody is very downtrodden, and that if the level of expectation goes up and the government can't provide what people think they deserve or need, and that's when they're in most danger. And then the next question, which is, as I say, related, is on that same level, are we not in danger of having serious resource wars when governments cannot provide within their own infrastructure for what people want? And I'm thinking, if we're really in a post-petroleum era in terms of energy, how about things like water?
Mm. Good question.
Yeah, so that's two very separate questions. It's true about the idea that when things start to get better, then people have rising expectations and they're more likely to become politically active, whereas if they're just uniformly downtrodden, sometimes it's easier to keep them that way. But if their rising expectations are being met by rising economies, then you don't have that problem. It's mostly when they get the rising expectations, things start to get better, and then they reverse, or it's blocked by a corrupt government or military takeover or a war, then you'll have some very angry people. That's kind of what happened in Yugoslavia in the early 90s. They were on a rising path, and then the economy went bad, and then communism collapsed, and you got those wars of the former Yugoslavia. The second question about the resources is not so straightforward in my mind as the idea that we're going to run out of resources and it'll cause more conflict. Certainly climate change is going to cause a lot of disruption to resources, water, oil, et cetera, as you say. But that doesn't necessarily mean violence will ensue from it. And I'll give you an example where the Caspian Sea has a lot of oil under it, and there were two countries, the Soviet Union and Iran, that owned that sea. And then the Soviet Union broke up, and suddenly there were six countries, and they discovered a lot more oil there. So there was a big resource competition at work. You would think they would all move their warships in and start, you know, grabbing resources by military force, but that doesn't work because you can't pump oil when you're fighting a war. So what actually happened is they yelled at each other for a couple of years, and then they got out maps and started drawing lines on the maps and started dividing up the resources. Similarly, Israel and Lebanon they have a conflict about natural gas offshore, but they solve that problem without resort to war because they want to pump the gas. So it's not always true that having a conflict about resources means you're going to solve it violently. Much more often, it's solved nonviolently.
Hmm. Anything else, Scott?
Well, I'd like to thank you for in this particular day and age, giving us something positive to think about. That's a welcome change for sure. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Yeah, that's one of the things that caught our attention with this. Positive news here. This is positive. What about, back on the same area of resources, what about refugees? We hear that there are going to be a lot of people, particularly on island nations and areas very close to oceans, that will have to be relocated should climate change really get very, very substantial here. Does that create more poverty in the host countries that may accept them, more people who don't have anything, thus creating conditions for maybe not war, but certainly major disagreements?
Well, so let me just say first, the refugee crisis that we're in now is a war-related crisis, and so have most of the refugee problems of recent decades. So we've got the big war in Syria. It's generating enormous numbers of refugees, and the answer to that is to solve the war in Syria. Climate change is a much more slow-acting process, and it cuts both directions because the same processes of burning fossil fuels to industrialize, which are causing climate change and eventually going to flood out the farmers in Bangladesh, are also creating higher incomes for the farmers in Bangladesh. You see what I mean?
Yes.
So the economies are developing over a period of decades, and the climate is causing, you know, these serious disruptions over that same period of decades. So the higher incomes mean less likely to have war. The displacement of people would be, I guess, more likely to have wars or at least to disrupt things. What we need to do is get off fossil fuels and be able to industrialize along clean lines, and then we would solve both of those problems. But it's not clear. It's not like climate change is going to cause this big wave of refugees the way that a war does. It's a much more slow-acting process.
Thanks, Scott, so much for your call. Let's go to Marcus in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Professor Goldstein. I respectfully disagree with you on the points, on several points. First being that there are no military governments left in the Western Hemisphere. I would argue that Ecuador and Cuba both have military governments that are in place. In terms of war as a large-scale event, I would say that there's been a rebranding of, you know, armed conflict as terrorists, even when it, you know, leans more towards being civil war or, you know, inter-country war. There's still plenty going on in the Congo. They're heading in a path, I believe, towards more armed conflict. You have Myanmar, you have China having, and North Korea having brutal suppression of their population. You have land grabs by Russia around the Caspian in the Ukraine, as well as countries like China and others trying to grab the Senkaku Islands off of Japan. And so I believe that at this point we may be headed in a direction towards more large-scale armed conflict, being that Russia's rising again as a superpower to rival the United States, and you're starting to see these geopolitical flare-ups between the two superpowers, i.e. Syria, and that, you know, as the economy of the world, which many economists have pointed to cannot continue at the sustained rate that it's been, that we're going to have economic slowdown, which I would argue would lead towards more armed conflict as people, where they start to acquire money, then end up putting that money into weapons to go for land grabs and material resource grabs from other countries.
Yeah, so I'm not sure we disagree as much as one might think, because what you're saying is there's a lot to worry about in the future, which I agree with. And what I'm saying is that right now things are better than they were in the past, which I also agree with. The one thing I want to pick up that you said, which I do agree is quite worrisome, is the Ukraine-Russia situation. And the reason I'm so concerned about that particular one is it's the only case where a UN member, Russia, has seized territory from another UN member, Ukraine. It's a flagrant violation of the UN Charter. And that kind of thing hasn't happened in decades and decades. So it's a very bad step in a wrong direction, and it pushes up against this line of countries not fighting each other anymore. I mean, it wasn't quite an official Russian-Ukrainian war, but it's awfully close. You know, Russian military forces in fighting against Ukrainian military forces, that's died down somewhat, and it's worrisome that it would escalate to full-scale war, and it's worrisome that Russia would get away with this land grab, which is really unprecedented. The rest of the things, war turning into terrorism and so forth, I'm not as concerned about. I mean, I'm concerned about them, but, you know, compared to the past where we had big wars, we also had a lot of terrorism. And think about Vietnam, and people were blowing up cafes with bombs all the time and that kind of thing. It just was in the context of a bigger war, so it didn't get as much attention. And the irony here, perhaps, is that as there are fewer of the big wars, the smaller terrorist attacks stand out more, and so we pay more attention to them, which is probably reasonable that when you solve one problem or mostly solve it, then the next one comes down the line, you worry more about that. But overall, the terrorist attacks are just so much smaller. I mean, you can count the number of people dying in political violence around the world, and even with the war in Syria, we're now at less than half what it was back in the 1980s during the Cold War. There are just fewer wars, and the ones that are left are smaller. So that's a step in the right direction. Does it mean that there's nothing to worry about in the future? No. I mean, this whole thing could reverse, and we did have a reversal a few years ago, where we'd been on a declining path for a couple of decades since the Cold War ended, and then it turned around, and with the war in Syria, the number of deaths started to go up again. The regions affected by war started to spread, like up into Europe with Ukraine and Russia, and there was a definite reversal. What we said in this recent Boston Globe article is that that reversal, which looked like it might then just lead to an escalation right back to where we were in the Cold War, doesn't seem to be doing that. It seems to have topped out now. It might even be down a little bit this year. Maybe that trend is back in the right direction again. Does that mean that it won't reverse again or that we don't need to worry about the future? Absolutely not. I'm a worrier myself, so I'm always worried that stuff's going to happen in the future and things will get really bad again.
Hmm. What about in the South China Sea, though? That's another UN country going for a land grab or a sea grab, if you will, where they've taken territorial fishing waters from countries like Vietnam, Thailand, Japan, as well as other nations in the area. And you also still have escalating wars in countries like Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Oman, and as always, Palestine and Israel is still fighting, too.
Yeah, Palestine and Israel is pretty low level, but boy, it's the oldest one in the world, and it would be so great to finally solve that, but we're not there. The South China Sea I'm concerned about because it has this potential of countries fighting each other. The island grabbing, well, they're not actually kind of invading and kicking out the other side's military forces like a real war. It's more this, it's a little similar to what Russia does, where they infiltrate their forces and then take something over. But the Philippines took China to court, to an international arbitration court, and won a big settlement against China. And it has put some pressure on China that, you know, now they're, if they continue on the path they're on, they're in violation of international law. And it's too soon to say, but that may be a constraining element. So far, it hasn't flared up into actual military conflict. People are not shooting each other's planes down over these islands. There are no naval battles going on. Actually, there hasn't been a naval battle in the world for about 25 years now, so that's a whole category that doesn't seem to be happening anymore. But certainly there's potential for bad stuff to happen in the South China Sea, and it's something of great concern.
Thank you, Marcus, for your questions. Let's go back to Ukraine and Russia for just a moment, which you described as dying down a little bit now. What makes things die down for a while and then heat up again? And what makes you worry about that part of the world heating up? What would precipitate that?
Well, the big heating up happen when one of the parties decides to really heat it up. For instance, if Russia decides that they want to go further to war in Ukraine and they want to grab more territory and more overtly bring in their military forces to do that, that would heat it up. So that's the main cause. But there's a second thing that can happen where accidents occur. Things that weren't planned can escalate out of control. I'll give you an example. During the civil war in Lebanon in the 1980s, there was a ceasefire all along a long line where the parties were arrayed against each other, and somebody had a wedding and fired guns into the air to celebrate, and the people on the other side thought they were being shot at, and they shot back, and then the first side shot back, and the whole civil war started up over that. And then you've got to try to tamp it down again. So we have mechanisms there in Russia and Ukraine. There are mechanisms to try to stop things from escalating, and there are negotiations and diplomacy going on. That's a good thing. But if one of the sides, probably Russia, decides they want to escalate, then the diplomacy won't stop that from happening.
Let's go next to Jocelyn in Sheboygan. Hi.
Hi. I don't know. I just don't agree with your guest, as far as the overall picture of what's happening on this poor planet. I mean, to me, everything is related to the population of humanity. The more people you have, the more resources you have to take at the expense of every other living thing. And I just don't see, it seems like people just don't want to admit that it's just so, everything is just so insane as far as, it seems like we've been killing each other since we've been on this planet. And it never stops. And not only do we kill each other, we kill every other poor creature that can't fight against us. I mean, it's just so appalling. I'm a senior citizen, and I do not see that humanity is getting any better.
Professor Goldstein.
Well, it is true we've been killing each other since we've been on the planet, so it's not all a pretty picture by any means, but we are killing fewer of each other now, despite the fact that our population has gone up and up and up. And also the level of prosperity per person has been going up, despite the fact that population is rising. Now, are we doing that at the expense of the natural world and messing things up beyond belief with climate change? Yes. So that I don't disagree with. But the idea that things are just getting worse and worse, that's just not true. It's a much more mixed picture, and I would say more positive than negative.
And we go next to Tim in Eau Claire. Hi, Tim.
Hi. We may be arguing semantics here, but you had said just a moment ago that we haven't had any naval wars in 25 years or something to that general effect. I guess in the sense of boats shooting at boats, sure, we haven't. But the U.S. is very good at using its aircraft carriers in the Gulf area to launch bombing runs and things of that nature, where we are effectively fighting a naval war, just nobody shooting at our boats.
Yeah, no, point well taken. I meant a naval battle, boats against boats, and certainly the U.S. Navy never sees a day of peace in recent years. So your point's taken.
Thank you, Tim, for your call. We'll take more in a moment. We're speaking this hour of the show with the co-author of a piece that caught our attention in the Boston Globe a little while back, The Decline of War and Violence, 2016 quietly shaping up as a good year for peace in the world. Now, not every part of the world is at peace, certainly. We're dealing with terrorism and We're dealing with a horrible war in Syria, but the level of war violence has fallen markedly, so says our guest. And our guest is Professor Joshua Goldstein, Professor Emeritus of International Relations at American University. He's also a research scholar in the Department of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He is the author of a number of books pertinent to our conversation, Winning the War on War, The Decline of Armed Conflict Worldwide. Our phone number for you to join this conversation, lines are open for you right now. They have been rather busy. The number to call is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number, and let's go to Jerry next in Madison. Hello, Jerry.
How are you?
All right, Jerry. How are you?
Good. What a fascinating discussion. Your guest is obviously very knowledgeable on world affairs. And you've been very supportive, sir, of the role of the United Nations in diminishing the amount of war. That's, you rarely ever hear anybody supporting the United Nations anymore. Every right-wing politician in the U.S. certainly never sides with the U.N. and its importance. And I understand the history of the League of Nations and the U.S. even wouldn't join. And then finally, give us a couple of your points on why you think the UN is so important to war prevention.
Well, first of all, it's the craziest thing where everybody supports the United Nations, but nobody thinks anybody else does. If you actually take a poll of Americans, 80% of them support the United Nations. They want to use it more. They recognize that it saves us money and makes us more effective. The UN can't ever do anything the U.S. doesn't like because we have the veto power and we're the host nation. And even if you ask people, should we use the UN even though it means we won't always get our way, they still say yes, you know, most of the time we will, and it's more useful than that. So everyone supports it, and yet the dialogue, the discourse is always that the UN is terrible and nobody supports it. And certainly it does have problems. The bureaucracy is, a little bit dysfunctional. The peacekeeping missions run into problems and so forth. But underneath all that, the UN peacekeeping in particular is 100,000 people around the world keeping the peace in more than a dozen conflict zones. It's the largest deployed army in the world now, these 100,000 people. And the research shows that ceasefires used to break down about half the time, but when peacekeepers are deployed, that drops to almost as low as 10% of the time. So a lot more stability is afforded and the chance to end wars rather than have them keep springing to life again as you have without the peacekeepers. So peacekeepers are very effective. And the thing I always point to with peacekeepers is how cheap they are for us. The average American household spends about $600 every month per household on our military forces and related.
Really? $600 a month? Wow.
Yep. Military is very expensive.
Yeah.
And yet we spend on UN peacekeeping $2 a month. So my radical, crazy idea is what if we up that $2 to $4? Because the peacekeeping forces are always underfunded, under-resourced. They don't have boots. They don't have helicopters. They don't have paper to write their reports on. It's always a struggle. If you really look at the problems that have happened in peacekeeping operations, so much of the time it comes down to a lack of resources. Usually it's that simple. They don't have enough money. They don't have enough people to get done the job that they're tasked with doing. But when they are better resourced, they're much more successful. I'll give you an example. We sent about 20,000 peacekeepers to the Democratic Congo, where the previous caller mentioned there still is fighting going on. But back in the 1990s, there were 6 foreign armies in the country. It was really much worse than it is now. We're sitting in the 20,000, they've had some success there, but they've always been stretched. It's a country the size of Western Europe. 20,000 is not very many people. And then in Sierra Leone up in West Africa, they had a civil war, and we sent in 20,000 peacekeepers there. but the country is much, much smaller than the Congo. So it ended up, you know, 10 times the size relative to the population in the country. And we were much more successful in Sierra Leone and ending the war, keeping it ended, helping the country get back on its feet. And those peacekeepers have gone home now. And then the Ebola virus hit, and the country's had problems with that. But the war hasn't started up again. And that's been a tremendous success story. So given enough resources, peacekeepers can be much more effective.
Mm. Thanks.
The General Assembly, with all the dictators coming in and making their speeches and all that, well, it's a place to talk. You know, it's not really doing that much. The Security Council has been a lot more effective since the Cold War ended, and now it's becoming a little less effective now that the great powers are not in agreement about things, but it still performs a very important function, especially in those conflicts where the great powers do agree.
Mm. How about NATO?
NATO is an important, it's the world's by far strongest military alliance, and it has an important role to play. It's always been struggling to define its role since the Cold War ended, and now Russia has given it the gift of giving it a new meaning in life, because now Russia seems like a threat again. I think NATO has an important positive role to play in keeping its countries together, as opposed to everybody just kind of going their separate way and trying to make their own policy separately.
Thanks, Jerry, for your call. And we go to Claire in Madison. Hello, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen. What a stunning, stunning announcement that we are spending $600 a month per household. Did I hear that right, Professor?
That's right. Very, very expensive, and it's eating into all the other things that you might want to be spending money on, our economy, our social services, education, etc. And that in a world where there's less war going on. So I'll give you an example. There hasn't been a major tank battle in 10 years, more than 10 years in the world, and yet we put so much money and effort into being ready for a tank battle. I just don't think that our military is really adapted yet to the world that we're living in, which is different than the one where a lot of the senior leadership of the military came up in during the Cold War. So I believe that we could adapt, change, and shrink our military appropriately to have the forces that we need for the threats we face today, to not go gallivanting off into countries where we don't do very well, trying to invade, and to redirect resources where they're more appropriately used, and, as I say, give more support to things like the United Nations, which often can do what we can't do. So I'll probably get in trouble for saying all that, but that's how I feel. That I'm not anti-military, but I feel we are spending too much and, in more importantly, in the wrong ways right now.
All right, Claire, go ahead.
Well, that was going to be the point of my call, too, sir. President Eisenhower was the first one to talk about the military-industrial complex, and we Americans have been suckered into this huge, huge, bottomless pit of military spending. And as I recall, it's something like 47% of the U.S. budget goes to military. And we're wasting so much money. And now that I've heard it's $600 per household per month, and obviously we can be fighting smarter. Look what President Obama has done in the Middle East with special forces, just these small forces going in. And they're much more effective than thousands and thousands and thousands of troops just taking over a country.
We have about 30 seconds, Professor.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think that this is all part of recognizing a changing world in which the type of war and the scale of war is changing, and that we need to adapt with it and make an opportunity out of it. The trouble is when we're all fixated on the latest terrorist attack and feeling scared all the time, then we can't really think clearly about how we're spending our resources.
Mm. Well, thank you for doing a lot of thinking on the whole area, Professor. Thanks. It was a really interesting hour.
Thanks for the chance to be on.
Yeah, our pleasure. Professor Joshua Goldstein, Professor Emeritus of International Relations at American University. The article is not saying war is over, but it is saying the decline of war and violence. Was in the Boston Globe. It's on our Facebook page if you would like to read it. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and to KP as well for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. News is coming up. We're with you again tomorrow.